Do you want to learn interesting psychological information in an easy, straightforward, and entertaining manner? Then you need to listen to The Shrink Is In, a podcast show produced and hosted by Dr. Howard Gurr. Dr. Gurr is a practicing licensed psychologist for more than 25 years in New York State, and now he is available to you on the internet. Now, here's Dr. Howard Gurr.
Hey, it's Dr. Howard Gurr with another psychology podcast. And today's podcast is a conversation between myself and Dr. Gaston Weiss. And today we're going to talk about autism, which is an important subject. I've had some earlier podcasts covering it. But Dr. Weiss is more expert in the field. And we're going to tap his brain about autism, what we know, what we don't know, and what we should know. So let me give you a little background about Dr. Weiss. Dr. Weiss first received his master's in marriage and family counseling from Queens College and his doctorate in school community psychology from Pace University. He's a New York State licensed psychologist and a New York State certified school psychologist. Presently, he's employed as a school psychologist in Valley Stream, and he has a private practice in Lynbrook where he works with children, adolescents, and adults, and he's an adjunct instructor at Adelphi University in Garden City, New York. Dr. Weiss has a website called www.weissdoc.com, spelled W-E-I-S-Z-D-O-C.com, where he has organized various resources for school psychologists, parents, teachers, and anyone interested in psychology and education. He hosts his own podcast called School Psychology Podcast with Dr. Gaston Weiss and a weblog called drweiss.blogspot.com, which includes a link to the podcast, show notes for the podcast, as well as many links relevant to school psychology. And now, let's meet Dr. Gaston Weiss. So, Gaston, welcome to the show. Glad you're here.
My pleasure, Howie. Thanks for inviting me.
So, I understand, Gaston, you're a fellow podcaster, and that you've recently started your own podcast called the School Psychology Podcast with Dr. Gaston Weiss. So, I know what sucked me into podcasting. What got you interested?
Okay, well, for better or worse, yes, I am on the air, available for people to listen to. I really love teaching and learning and the interaction, the educational interaction. I've done staff developments at the school where I work, and I've recently started teaching a school psychology graduate course. And I also love listening to podcasts as well. And basically with a podcast, if you have anything that you could talk about that you have some material on, you could do a podcast. So I decided I would try it, and I've done 12 at this point, and I've been really enjoying it. It's kind of like a little bit of a hobby and also a little bit of an opportunity to explore things in psychology that I find interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's what drove me to it, that it was something fun and interesting and different, but it also allows me to, you know, look at things from a different angle and communicate that to the public, who I believe is on some level starved for appropriate psychological information.
I definitely agree. I find people are extremely interested, and they don't always know where to access the information, and sometimes they get information that's incorrect and or confusing, and they really do want to get information from us, and we're not always you know, we don't always have hours and hours on our time, on our hands to talk. So I thought this would be a good way for people to get information about maybe a topic they're interested in, an area that they just want to know a little more about that I might have talked about for 5 minutes with somebody, but there's a lot more information on it.
So I listened to your series on autism that you produced, the last three shows. And I found them very interesting. And so I thought it would be informative for my audience, who might be slightly different than your audience, to kind of pick your brain about autism. And I was wondering if you could specify really some information that really is known about autism at this point.
Okay, sure. As you may know, that autism is fairly recent in people's awareness. I think some time ago, very few people knew about it. Now everybody's talking about it. There's specials on it, and people are very interested in it. Leo Kanner is an important name in the field. He identified autism back in 1943, and since that time, we've although it's only a few decades, there's been a great deal of research, a great deal of literature about autism, and also diagnostically speaking, the way that we diagnose the disorder is different. We have now some categories within what's called the autism spectrum disorders.
Mm-hmm.
So there's five different diagnoses, and it's not just the classic autism that people think of if they went to school. When I went to school, Kanner's autism or classic autism. Now we know also about Asperger's syndrome, where verbal skills are significantly better than with autism.
Mm-hmm.
And some other disorders also, Rett's syndrome, childhood disintegrative disorder, where there's a regression in functioning. And then there's the pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, which is admittedly a sort of a ambiguous category slightly.
Right.
But it covers those people who might have aspects or symptoms but don't fit neatly into one of the other categories. The thing that's important to know about the autism spectrum disorders basically is that it's a developmental disorder. Usually symptoms present by the age of 3, and there are 3 main areas of impairment that we see. One is in communication, one is in social functioning, and the third area has to do with restricted or repetitive interests, activities, or behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
So so those are what they have in common. And then there's much more information, of course, about people with autism as well, which, you know, but those are the 3 basics to get sort of a general idea of it.
You know, I remember in the old days, autism was a rather rare diagnosis, at least my experience, you know, when I first started practicing.
Right.
And now, you see a tremendous number of kids who are what we call spectrum disordered kids.
Mm-hmm.
So the literature kind of suggests it's much more common. Is that true, or are we just diagnosing it more?
Well, maybe it's a combination of factors. The fact is that to some extent people are more aware and they're more likely to diagnose it, because just like ADHD or anything else, once people become aware of it, it's mm-hmm. more likely people are going to diagnose it. The other thing, too, is that the categories now have broadened. So you do have these other categories like Asperger's syndrome.
Right.
People might not have thought of as autistic at all.
Mm-hmm.
They might have viewed a person with Asperger's as quirky or unusual or something, but not necessarily even fitting into the category. We believe it is the fastest growing special education category. The estimates are that there's about 1 in 500 who have autism, more in boys than girls, 4 times as often in boys than girls.
Mm-hmm.
And some people have, you know, postulated ideas that there's an increasing number of children with autism. But that's very hard to say, and it probably a lot of this does have to do with awareness and diagnostic differences, and it's very hard to tease out other factors. There may be, but it would be hard to tell.
Have there been any notable developments in the field recently?
Okay, well, there's been some developments. It used to be thought people with autism basically had an extremely poor prognosis.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority were destined to live out their lives needing intensive supervision and support. There's much more that we now know that we can do to improve functioning for people with autism. And there's some dramatic improvement that we do see with children who do get intervention early. And now autism can be recognized extremely early as 18 months.
Really? Are there significant signs that they look for at 18 months?
They will look for around the first couple of years, a lot of times doctors or parents will notice either a lack of development of social and language skills or interpersonal skills, or sometimes a regression. And in the past, again, when people were not that aware of autism and also thought of it as extremely rare, this might not have been noticed and thought of as being too significant. There's also a screening that's very easy to give called the CHAT, C-H-A-T, that doctors have more access to, that is a very, very quick screening that can help the doctor make a recommendation for a more involved evaluation. And there's also much more, as you probably know, also as a school psychologist, there's so much more early intervention and preschool special education services, and people are more aware of supports that are available free through county services available. And many more people are aware of the ability to evaluate their children.
I think what I find also is the pediatricians are much more aware too, and they're very comfortable in recommending parents to seek services for their 2 and 2.5 year old children, which was much more, it's more common today than it was years ago.
Right, and there's an interplay between the pediatricians and the parents, because parents are more comfortable taking their kids for evaluations and early services, and sometimes pediatricians might have been afraid of scaring a parent by, by bringing up the possibility that there's something wrong with their child.
Right.
Parents are much more proactive, much more educated, and sophisticated, and pediatricians and parents really have a better dialogue than they ever had in the past.
You know, you talked about early identification. Is there kind of a significant benefit to this early recognition of autism in terms of getting services early?
Yes, there definitely is. Among the most evidence-based research findings there are, number one, that early intervention is responsible for dramatically better outcomes in functioning for children with autism. That can be speech therapy. It could be special education services. It could be various kinds of interventions. But these are children who are very hard to teach. They have a really hard time learning skills unless they have very specialized one-to-one or small group educational and individualized educational approaches. So that's one of the approaches that is evidence-based. We also see many programs that are using behavioral approaches, and many people hear about ABA and think that means discrete trial training or some very specific aspect of ABA. But really just basically all kinds of approaches that are based on behavior research that we see tend to work. And that would include things like picture communication systems for autistic children who have a hard time speaking, using pictures to communicate and to follow schedules is really helpful. And using approaches like functional behavior assessments, using peer mediation intervention. Social stories is an exciting approach that is very helpful for children with autism. And a variety of specialized educational approaches have been found to be helpful. So in terms of that, that's, under the category, I guess, of special education or individualized education. And the third area, I guess, is the medical area, which Not that there's a medication for autism, but there are some children who have symptoms that can be helped with medication. So there are some children who do benefit from medication, or some adults and children who benefit from medication.
So those are the things that we find that work. In your podcast, you mention claims and treatments that are not helpful or even, you know, are false claims. Can you talk about the unsubstantiated programs and claims out there?
Sure. Yeah, I try to divide my podcast series into three parts: what we know, what we don't know, and when we should know better. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of my little way of saying, you know, that we have to really be careful with the unsubstantiated claims. I should make a distinction. Something that's not proven doesn't mean it doesn't work or that there's no possibility of it working. But if it's not proven, we just don't have the same level of confidence as the things that we do have that are proven. Mm-hmm. But autism basically has been like a magnet for wild theories and ideas, questionable interventions, and a whole lot of pseudoscience or anti-science and things like that. Early in our history as a profession, actually, Bruno Bettelheim had the theory that autism was not biological at all, and that it was really caused by poor parenting. And we now know that that's not true, but countless professionals really had that belief, and with very, very little reason to view that as the scientific belief. There's really no evidence for it. There's on PBS, there's a website, on the PBS website, they have a documentary that they have on sale there called Refrigerator Mother, which is about these mothers who were victims to this this abuse. Mm-hmm. But that was, you know, that's not in vogue anymore. But we do have the intervention and the claims du jour with autism, some of which are more popular and some of which are less. One of the more popular claims is that childhood vaccines cause autism. And I certainly, I have no qualms with parents being concerned because it's understandable. It's a devastating diagnosis. It's certainly horrible if your child seems to be functioning and then suddenly there's a dramatic change, you know, you wonder what happened. And the truth is that the MMR vaccines are given to children around the same age.
Right. Yeah, right,
that
the same
we're
time.
Seeing symptoms, right? So I'd be scared, you know, it's understandable. But as far as the science behind it, the evidence doesn't indicate that there's a connection. And more to help people not fear vaccines, The product was changed so that there's no longer this mercury product in the vaccines, and we still see, you know, kind of the same pattern with autism. So it doesn't appear that the vaccines caused it, and also certainly nobody should fear getting vaccinated based on what we know evidence-wise, because there's no mercury in the vaccines now anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I believe this may be a connection to that, the method called chelation, which is to a method of removing heavy metals and mercury poisoning from a person who's had mercury poisoning, has been used for children with autism.
Really?
Again, the cause theory and the treatment theory are not at all supported by research, and it's a very dangerous procedure.
Right.
So it's definitely something, if I could, you know, get out the message that there's things to be skeptical of, and that you know, you wouldn't do something that there's no basis for doing in any medical situation when you do have medical approaches that do seem to be helpful, and you have plenty of evidence that, you know, there's nothing to do with mercury.
You know, I think what happens is, you're right, the parents become devastated and desperate to find a solution for their problems with their children. And there are, you know, people out there who will prey upon them with dubious science at best. I remember years ago I had a woman who I was seeing, her son who had significant learning problems, but he was 14 years old. You got to keep that in mind. And she told me that she found a chiropractor who could adjust her son in such a way that his reading problem would disappear. And I suggested she not go there. Mm-hmm. And it was $100 a session with this chiropractor. Mm. And I told her, if you want to get a benefit of your $100, mm-hmm. I would suggest more likely it would be better to take the $100 bill, smash it into a little ball, and throw it in your furnace. At least you'll get heat out of it. But she chose to go to this chiropractor anyway. Now, this chiropractor's office was in Brooklyn, and she went three times in 3 days. Mm. And on the third day, she said it was amazing. Her son was reading the signs on the highway. Mm. And I said, your son's 14 years old. I don't care if his reading level was a fourth grade reading level. He could read those signs. Mm-hmm. I said, your $300 in chiropractic adjustments really didn't fix him.
Right.
But she didn't quite believe that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so unfortunately, when people get desperate, there's always somebody out there with a magical solution to their problems.
Right. And the need for hope is an important need, and you can't take it away. And I kind of, you know, I'm afraid sometimes to be too strong in telling someone that something is a total waste, you know, because mm-hmm. the hope, I mean, there is such a thing as the benefit of positive thinking and a little bit of placebo expectation effect, whatever you want
sure.
to call it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be most concerned about those treatments that really cause harm. Mm-hmm. I would be more concerned about chelation than I would about chiropractic treatment. But I'd be concerned about chiropractic treatment also because there's no evidence that it cures all the things they say they cure, you know, including learning disabilities and autism and various things, cancer, you know, whatever you have, there's mm-hmm. a chiropractor who says they'll cure it. So I'd be concerned certainly about wasting money, time, and energy.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be, I guess, on a priority list, you know, you have to be most concerned about those things that might lead to real harm, like mm-hmm. chelation therapy or not being vaccinated. It's very dangerous not to be vaccinated. There's other things like crawling therapy, holding therapy. Again, it's a matter of putting your energy and your time and your money into something that hasn't been proven to be effective.
Right.
When it comes to things like nutritional supplements, I always tell people, patients and parents in my school and people I know, whatever, that I tell them to check with their doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Something might seem totally harmless because it's in a health food store, and it might actually be quite harmful. So
sure.
just because, you know, anything that you take in your ingest could be, you know, could be, if it's effective enough that it could do some good, then it could do some harm.
You know, I always tell people that just because it's in a health food store and it's a natural supplement, that doesn't mean anything, really, because
right.
all medications, for the most part, many of them actually are from natural areas, natural
sure.
supplements. And the other thing is that if you take what looks like a harmless vitamin at toxic levels,
mm-hmm.
you know, it becomes a medication.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, if there are side effects due to that medication, you know, that the vitamin kind of mimics in a sense,
yeah.
then the side effects will be there for the vitamin as well
right.
if you're taking it at massive doses.
Right.
So
and,
it's not all safe.
You don't have a psychiatrist helping to control the amounts.
Right.
You have a health food store clerk for your psychiatrist, which is a problem.
And the vitamins and minerals and herbs in the health food store aren't regulated.
Right.
So you have no idea about concentrations as well.
That's right. And one time you buy it, it could be a different concentration than another
right.
time you buy it.
Yeah.
Another one is secretin therapy, which I didn't research that much, but that apparently is also a very popular therapy that was one of the ones I saw debunked on some of the debunk sites like Quackwatch mm-hmm. and Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, another good site for pseudoscience debunking as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so people have to be careful about the path they pick to help their child, and it would be smart of them to pick appropriate and scientifically based treatments
mm-hmm.
that would make sense as opposed to these hocus-pocus kind of, you know, magical choices out there that sound good but aren't really beneficial.
No question about that.
Well, unfortunately, Gaston, we're way out of time. We're a little bit longer than I thought we were going to go, but I thought the information was too important to cut you off, because this is an area that I think has to be out there and addressed, because there are too many people out there who are misguided and going in the wrong directions to help their kids, and we want them to help their kids the correct way.
Well, thank you very much, Howie. You made this is a great opportunity to give out some good information and to share that kind of important points.
Right. I appreciate that. And if anyone wants to hear more information about this, they can hear your three series podcasts on your school psychology podcast with Dr. Gaston Weiss. And I just want to spell that. It's W-E-I-S-Z. And it's all one word in your podcast.
Yeah, if you go into iTunes and you put in school psychology, there's not that many podcasts with it, so you'll see it'll come up as one of them. Or you can go to my site, weissdoc.com. That's also that funny spelled last name, weissdoc.com.
And again, Gaston, I want to thank you.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
So until next time, this has been Dr. Gurr for The Shrink Is In.
You have been listening to The Shrink Is In, and your host has been Dr. Howard Gurr. If you want to learn more about Dr. Gurr, go to his website at www.drsgurr.com.